is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn what women need to know about stroke and how relationships play a central role in healing. But first, what do you need to consider before embarking on a living donor kidney transplant? In the United States, there are over 100,000 people on waiting lists for organ donations. And for some, time can simply run out. And kidneys are among the organs with the greatest demand and the greatest transplant success, with living donor transplants essential to this success. Here with more on this is Ellen Havens, a registered nurse and certified clinical transplant coordinator on the Kidney Transplant Service at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Ellen. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So nationwide, kidneys are in very high demand. Tell us about that. Why are they in more demand, perhaps, than other organs?
There are many people who are suffering from different medical diseases that affect kidneys, diabetes, hypertension, various diseases, polycystic kidney disease, various autoimmune diseases that affect kidneys.
And has that been growing over the years? In other words, has the demand increased? And if so, why?
More people are suffering from diabetes, especially, and hypertension.
So with the obesity potential, the obesity increase in this country, and therefore often diabetes going along with that, we're
exactly.
Seeing more demand, more kidney failure, and more demands for kidney transplants.
Yes, that is one of the biggest things that affects, that will affect people getting diabetes is obesity, yes.
How, at this point in Central New York, how many people do you think are roughly on waiting lists for a kidney transplant?
Between Syracuse and Rochester, there's probably about a little bit more than 500.
Wow. So people are basically hanging around waiting. How does that affect their lives? I mean, in the opening I mentioned that for some people time can run out. I mean, what actually happens if people are waiting a very long time? How does it affect their health?
People can wait in our area about 4 to 7 years.
Wow.
Waiting for a deceased donor to come forward for a transplant.
And what happens? I mean, have we lost people along the way?
Yes. If they're on dialysis, we know that they don't live as long waiting for a kidney transplant if they're on dialysis.
So would you say this is almost verging on a dire situation?
It can be for those people.
Let me get a better handle on the kinds of donation that exists. Okay, we've been talking living donor. Explain first, what is a living donor transplant?
Living donor transplant can be from someone who's a family member, a friend, or an acquaintance. A deceased donor transplant, of course, comes from someone who can be from a brain-dead donor. Can be from a donor who, after cardiac death, they call donation after cardiac death.
Explain those two. So, and how does that come about? In other words, is it something someone would have had to indicate their willingness to give an organ prior to an accident or aging or what have you? How does it come about that you do after death transplant?
The best thing to do is for someone to tell their family member that they want to be a donor. And, of course, when you go to the DMV nowadays or at the state fair, is the best thing to do is to sign your organ donor card.
And people can determine what organs they want to donate,
yes,
for example.
Yes, you can say. But the best thing to do is at the DMV is to sign when you're there doing whatever. Or you can go. There's so many places now you can do it. You can do it online. You can do it through your Facebook account.
Wow.
And say that you want to be an organ donor.
And basically, how popular is this now? I mean, I understand that you're having difficulty procuring kidneys at this point, or really organs in general, but kidneys in particular are in high demand. What seem to be the stumbling blocks in terms of getting these organs?
Unfortunately, in New York State, we are one of the lower states in having people signed up to be organ donors, and it has to do with the difficulty, difficulty in being able to do it. In other words, there's stumbling blocks that the state puts in
yes, this place?
Yes, basically.
So there are legal requirements?
Yes. You sign up, but then they have to send you some forms to fill out, and then you have to send them back. It's not electronic. And so if you have to do some extra steps in order to sign up, you know how it is. That form sits on your counter and might not ever get sent back in.
So it gets put to the bottom of the list very often. Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Kidney Transplant Coordinator Ellen Havens. We're talking about kidney transplants, the need for them, and at this point, the lack of kidneys. Just help us understand the two types that you mentioned after death have to do with brain death or cardiac death. Can you just quickly explain the difference between those two? I mean, how do they determine somebody is brain dead, for example?
Yes. Yeah, so someone someone is in an accident and they have a catastrophic injury, and there are brain death criteria, and two physicians will declare someone brain dead. Various tests are done. And if they're brain dead, there are no signs of life. And those patients are declared brain dead.
And in that case, if someone hasn't themselves offered to give a donation of their organs, does their family have the right at that point to decide, yes, let's say it's a teenage kid who had a motorcycle accident or something of that nature, do they have the right to then offer that child's or that person's organs
legally? Yes, and that's why it's important to make sure your family's aware of your wishes.
And how about in terms of cardiac death as well?
In cardiac death, there's a set of...
criteria?
Yes, there's a criteria that they follow that they try to predict. And there's a time frame. So they will take that patient to the operating room, and they will remove the life support. And if that patient goes on to death within 60 minutes, then that patient can then donate their organs. If that patient does not go on to death within that time frame, then that patient then goes back to the care that they were receiving prior to that. And usually that patient then just goes on to, you know, this comfort care until they pass.
So it sounds to me like the problem here is, in part, both that people are not necessarily coming forward to offer organs, either while they're alive, in terms of a kidney, a living donation, or in terms of this idea of donating your organs after death in some way. And I guess the question I have is, are there myths or things that get in the way, besides the paperwork part of it? Are there other things that people believe that might limit their desire or willingness to do this? I mean, I would think in some cases it might be a religious consideration. Some people may not feel that their religion allows them to do this.
Yeah, it's partly, sometimes it can be cultural. Sometimes people just think, well, I'm older. There's things that maybe wrong, they think that's wrong with them, that they don't qualify. And really, it's the health professionals that are from the organ procurement organization that really understand about who qualifies, that they need to be the ones that make those decisions. And
so if
you'd be surprised who qualifies, you know.
Let's talk a little bit then about the whole idea of living organ donation. Tell us what that is again. How is it? Does it work? I mean, obviously, if you give up a kidney, you still can live a normal lifespan. Is that correct?
That's true.
So
that's
tell us about that. How does one make that determination if they think they might want to give a kidney?
So we have our nephrologists say in general, you have to be more than perfectly healthy to give a kidney, and that's generally true. We put them through a very rigorous medical evaluation. It includes a medical evaluation, a psychosocial evaluation. We want to make sure that we have identified any risk factors that we would worry about them should they, as they age, anything that we would worry that would affect them if they were to only have one kidney as they age.
So your focus at that point is really on the health of the donor.
Absolutely.
Rather than the health of the kidney you're taking.
Absolutely. So we have a complete medical team, including a social worker, a nephrologist, a lab personnel, the nurse, and the surgeon, who only concentrates on the donor, completely separate from the medical team, the social work team that concentrates on the recipient.
Tell me something about the guidelines of who can donate then. Are there age requirements? Obviously, there wouldn't be a gender issue. What are some of the guidelines?
So they have to be greater than 18 years of age. We really don't have a cutoff for age at the upper end of the scale. We have had a donor who was 70 years old.
Really?
Who was a farmer, who was...
A living donor.
Living donor.
Wow.
He was a farmer. He had only one arm from a farming accident. He climbed the silo 2 or 3 times a week.
My goodness.
And so we thought, well, he's 70, you know. But, hey, when he came through and he showed us what he did on a weekly basis, we threw our arms up and said, hey, he's showing us that he's in great shape. And he actually did very well and had his surgery and went home 2 days later and back to work and within about 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow. So you do have all these steps to clearance to make sure that the person themselves, the donor themselves, will continue to live healthily post-surgery.
Exactly.
How about in terms of this whole idea of a match? I mean, how complicated is that? Or obviously people don't just donate a kidney into space. I mean, generally when they're donating a kidney, there is a recipient in mind. Am I correct?
Yes.
So how does that process work?
They come forward for their, you know, their cousin, their friend, whoever. We look at their blood typing. We make sure that their blood matches. We look at antigens, which are markers in their blood. We don't care too much about the markers because we can do a successful living donation transplant even if the markers aren't specifically perfect matches.
So this whole idea of rejection, these days you have better ways of dealing with rejection.
The medications are very good, and we don't care too much about that because just by rights of being a living donor, the kidney will last longer, and the medications are the same whether the matches perfect or 0 out of 6 or 6 out of 6 would be perfect.
How safe is it, though, both for the donor and the recipient? How safe are these kidney transplants these days? How successful are they?
It's 98%. We have a success rate of about 98%, 98 to 100% safe.
Wonderful. Well, very interesting information, very important. We hope that more people will consider this idea of kidney donation or donation of their organs in general. I want to thank you for coming in. My guest has been Ellen Havens. She's a registered nurse and certified clinical transplant coordinator on the Kidney Transplant Service at Upstate Medical University. Stroke and how to prevent them. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Did you know that stroke kills twice as many women as breast cancer every year? But in a recent survey, women believed that breast cancer was 5 times more prevalent than stroke. And 40% of women said that they were only somewhat or not at all worried about having a stroke. Well, here to tell us why this is of great concern to women and their health care providers is registered nurse Shelley Clark. She's the stroke program coordinator for Upstate University Hospital. Welcome, Shelley. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So women are vulnerable to having strokes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they definitely are. There are approximately 800,000 newer recurrent strokes every year, and more than half of those are women.
Wow.
And women, actually, we live longer. So as we know, there's a higher risk of stroke the older we get. And so women have a higher lifetime risk of stroke.
Wow. I'd bet most women would not even think that. It's always for someone else, always
right.
For the men.
Exactly. And the other concerns that are associated with women is that because we are older when we have our stroke, we may be alone and widowed. Or we may be part of that generation where maybe we're taking care of parents, or maybe we're taking care of children or grandchildren. So when we take that person out of commission, who then cares for the remainder of the family? So these characteristics, when we talk about the disability that may be associated with stroke, makes it so much more important in women that we understand how to recognize it and then how to prevent it.
Well, let's get to that, okay? But before we get to exactly how to recognize it, let's talk about what is a stroke, because mm-hmm. then I want to get to what women need to know and what to do about it. So first of all, what exactly is a stroke to start with?
Very simple level, stroke is an interruption of blood flow to the brain. We require a fresh supply of oxygen and nutrients for our brain all the time. So when something interrupts it, either due to a clot, which cuts off the blood supply to a portion of the brain, or a hemorrhage, where you have a ruptured blood vessel in the brain, that area of the brain is no longer getting the oxygen and nutrition it needs.
And therefore it leads to
brain tissue damage.
Some brain injury, basically.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what do women need to know or to do? First, let's talk about this acronym FAST, F-A-S-T. What does it mean? Because it's always in the news as a way of remembering what to do. Tell me about it.
Mm-hmm. FAST is the way we can recognize stroke happening in another person, and very often we are going to have to be the ones to call for that person because one of the disabilities may be speech. So FAST is face, arm, speech, time.
Okay, let's go through them really quickly. When you say face, what does that mean?
Face. We ask somebody to smile, and we look to see if they have some kind of a facial droop, which is showing us weakness or paralysis in that side of the face.
So that's one clue. What about arm?
Arm is we ask them to raise their arms, and either they can't raise an arm, or they can raise it, but they can't hold it up.
Okay. And speech?
Speech. We ask them to repeat a simple sentence. If I said, Linda, please say the sky is blue.
Mm-hmm. The sky is blue.
What that tells me is, A, you understood what I asked, B, you could obey the command, and C, you could articulate the words. All important pieces of assessing somebody's ability to speak.
And how about T for time? What does that mean?
Time is if you have a sudden onset of any one of these symptoms. You don't necessarily have to have all three. Please call 911. The faster you get into our facility, the faster we can recognize and treat you and hopefully decrease the amount of disability associated with that stroke.
Yes, as I've heard many times over, they talk about brain is time. So the faster you get help, the faster you get into a stroke center, the less damage that can be done to the brain, will be done to the brain.
Right, right. When we say time is brain, it's because we say that 2 million neurons per minute die as a result of being deprived of oxygen.
So let's go to this idea of women being different than men, because I know that mm-hmm. they've talked about that with heart attacks, mm-hmm. and I know that the evidence is not clear or definitive at this point that women have different symptoms, but you said that there seem to be some agreed upon differences. What are they?
Right. So a lot of what happened in the literature was when we did our initial testing, we did it more on men, and we thought that there were parallels, but now we're learning that's not necessarily true. So there's some literature that suggests that some very nonspecific type of symptoms, such as face or limb pain, especially on the affected side, if it's on one side of the body, or hiccups, nausea, general weakness.
And are these things that come on suddenly or that are going on for a long time?
They come on suddenly, but as you can imagine, chest pain, shortness of breath may be associated with something else. It may be associated with a heart attack. So while these symptoms independently, especially the ones of nausea and hiccups, may not necessarily in isolation mean you're having a stroke, if it's happening in combination with perhaps that facial droop or something, now all of a sudden that should raise your alert a little bit more.
So that in the context of these classic symptoms that you described before, mm-hmm. not raising your arm, not being able to speak or what have you, that's going to be an indication that you better get some help immediately.
Absolutely.
What, tell us about this thing called a mini stroke, because it's often bandied about as something not to worry about, or some people say, yes, you must worry about it. They call it a TIA, transient ischemic attack. Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, those of us who work in the stroke world really don't like the term mini stroke, because is there any such thing as a small stroke? So a TIA, by transient, it means temporary. So something had blocked that flow of blood so that you temporarily did not get oxygen to that part of the brain. But then something happened where that blood flow was restored. And as a result, you didn't end up with brain tissue damage. But it's a huge warning sign that you've got something going on in there. So we do not take them lightly.
So does that mean if you have one of these TIAs that you should get assistance or help?
Prompt treatment. And we still encourage, if you have the symptoms and they start to improve, still call 911, because you may or may not be having it and you can't tell just by yourself.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Shelley Clark. She's the stroke program coordinator for Upstate University Hospital. And we're talking about stroke in women and what you need to know. Let's talk about the risk factors that are specific to women, that may be also more specific to women, and what you can do about them. You mentioned to me at one point things like high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation, diabetes, migraines with aura. Let's take one at a time. What about high blood pressure?
So high blood pressure is the most common, what we call modifiable, meaning you can do something about it, risk factor for stroke. And it has the greatest impact on reducing stroke. This is true for both men and women. What we find in women, though, is that they are more likely to have high blood pressure, partly because we live longer. It occurs more likely after menopause. So for some reason, our hormones seem to have a protective nature. But more important than anything is that while we're more likely to be treated for the high blood pressure, we're less likely to be in control.
Really?
And so the control part of it. So when we hear women who say, oh, I take my medicine every day, but my blood pressure is still pretty high at whatever the number is, that makes me concerned, because that's exactly what we're talking about in terms of control.
So what do we do about it?
What do we do about it? A lot of times it's because either we've been on medications and we didn't like the side effects, or maybe we're not taking it seriously. Maybe we're not taking our blood pressure regular times and sort of advocating for ourselves. There are so many different types of blood pressure medicines and combinations.
But the message here is get it under control.
Get it under control and make sure you're having that dialogue with your primary care provider that you're worried about it as well as they should be.
What's atrial fibrillation and how does that lead to stroke?
Atrial fibrillation is an irregular heartbeat. And as a result of what happens in this irregular heartbeat, it sets up small clots. And these clots can then go to the brain, which increase your risk of stroke by 5 times.
Wow. So what do you do about it?
Well, women, because we live longer and we know that this occurs more likely as you get older, we're talking about having them regularly screened. And that can be done by a pulse check, as well as having an EKG in order to determine if you're having these symptoms.
And what can you do about those symptoms, though?
And then it's anticoagulation. We're looking at
blood
putting
thinners.
You on a, right, exactly, as some type of a blood thinner.
How about things like diabetes? You know, with the, as you mentioned, obesity and a kind of the metabolic syndrome that has come about, more and more women have diabetes. What do you need to do to make sure that doesn't lead to stroke?
Right. Metabolic syndrome is when we talk about the insulin resistance, diabetes, the increased waist circumference, especially if it's bigger than 35 inches, high triglycerides, which goes along with our cholesterol levels. and then the high blood pressure. The combination of those four actually put you at a higher risk of stroke. And compared to men, we're unsure why, but this metabolic syndrome, this combination, puts women at even a higher risk.
Wow.
So get the diabetes under control. Know what your blood sugar is. Know where your cholesterol levels and your triglyceride levels are trending. And then, of course, get that blood pressure under control.
So do migraines make you more susceptible to stroke?
Women are four times more likely to have migraines, and most of them are not associated, but there are certain things. We know that women who have migraines with aura, which is where they have that sort of, they know their migraine's coming, perhaps it's
a visual disturbance.
Correct. Especially if they have them under the age of 55, if they're on birth control with it, if they smoke with it, and if they have a lot of migraines, that's associated with a higher risk of having stroke.
So again, what do you do about it?
Talk to your primary care. Some of our primary care doctors are not all familiar with that. So there are treatments, but you have to have that dialogue.
Okay. What about oral contraception? Because we were talking about birth control pills as something. Does that make you more prone to something like a stroke? And should you know about your history in terms of those kinds of things?
That's the key, Linda, because oral contraceptive by itself does not necessarily carry a higher risk, but it does in older women, and by older I mean in their 40s and 50s who are on oral contraception, women who smoke, those who have that combination of the metabolic syndrome, any of those risk factors are going to put women on oral contraception at a higher risk for stroke.
So now when you talk about that, and this is hormones, how about pregnancy? Does that put you at a greater risk for stroke as well?
Pregnancy does, particularly if you have one of the associated eclampsia or one of the complications of pregnancy that's associated with a high blood pressure or any of these other, you're a diabetic. So again, every time we look at it, it's putting these risk factors together that makes such an impact.
And it sounds to me that they're almost cumulative.
Absolutely.
Tell us very briefly, overall, what should women then do?
So women need to know their risk factors, and we need to be empowered to take action to reduce those risks, to have the dialogue with our physicians, know how to recognize it, and then if you see somebody having it or if you see the symptoms in yourself, get help fast.
Very important information, very important facts. Thank you so much, Shelley. My guest has been Shelley Clark. She's the Stroke Program Coordinator for Upstate University Hospital. Once again, women need to pay attention that they too can have a stroke. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, this is Heather Richardson, registered dietitian in Upstate's Adult Medicine Department with Healthy Eats. Today, let's talk about vegetarianism. Some people wonder if it's a good idea to become a vegetarian. And as a registered dietitian, I would probably say, yes, it is a good idea. Reason being is that it's a plant-based diet that's highly recommended by many health organizations because it's naturally low in saturated fat, cholesterol, and animal protein. And you get a plentiful amount of micronutrients, which we don't get when we're focusing more on starch and protein in our diet. Also, it has a tremendous amount of benefits. We find that people who follow a vegetarian diet have a lower body mass index. They have a better blood pressure control, again, because they're eating more fruits and vegetables and whole grains. And they have a reduction in cancer rate. And that's because they're feeding their body with foods that are helping their vascular health or their blood health. And that's really what diet is all about. Whatever you eat goes into your stomach and then gets delivered to your blood. And your blood travels from the tip of your head to the tip of your toes. So you want to make sure that all those nutrients that get there are good and healthy. So a vegetarian simply is eating foods that are rich in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and legumes, all of these providing protein and vitamins and minerals. If you're a vegetarian that avoids meats and dairy products but eats fried foods and fast foods and junk foods, you're obviously not going to be getting enough of your good nutrients. So you really have to take a time to look at your diet, make a plan, and then analyze it. And if you feel like you can't do that yourself, then you probably should meet with a dietitian so that they can help you. But some of the points to look at are, are you getting enough protein? And protein is found for vegetarians and mostly in your nuts and your seeds, your soy products, your soy milk, and your legumes. And in combination with that, you're getting your zinc and your iron from some of those sources too, but you're getting them from your whole grains, your dried beans, your nuts, and your seeds, some yogurts, and dried fruits. Calcium and vitamin D are super important to make sure that you're getting enough of, especially if you're avoiding dairy products. So you have to make sure that you're getting fortified foods, whether it be from soy milk or soy products or orange juice or breakfast cereals. And calcium, of course, you can find in a wide variety of leafy greens, especially broccoli, or again, a fortified item. So the bottom line is a plant-based diet is a healthy diet, as long as you ensure to include these vital nutrients, protein, B12, vitamin D, calcium, zinc, and iron. This is Heather Richardson, registered dietitian, serving you healthy eats.
Next up, how relationships play a central role in healing. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I am Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for June 16. Eating out is one of life's great pleasures, but a restaurant menu can be tough to decipher. Remember that food served fried, au gratin, crispy, scalloped, pan-fried, sautéed, buttered, creamed, or stuffed are typically high in fat and calories. Be on the lookout for steamed, broiled, baked, grilled, poached, or roasted foods instead. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. World of medical practice with the cost-cutting demands of high volume and brief encounters, relationships are often excluded or the first to go. Well, here with me to shed a bit more light on the importance of relationship in the practice of healing is Dr. David Keith. He's a professor of psychiatry, the director of family therapy, director of the Naomi Chernoff MD Creativity Conference at Upstate Medical University, and for 10 years he served as the chief of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Upstate Medical as well. Welcome, Dr. Keith. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So relationships are critical in healing. Can you explain this and explain why?
Well, actually, we're always in relationships, so I'm thinking more about the quality of relationships. And the medical relationship in conventional medicine, internal medicine, surgery, the doctor is the superior, the person with superior knowledge, and the patient comes to gain from that knowledge. In psychotherapy, the relationship has more of a peer quality. That is, the patient is invited to take a more active role, thus to gain some sense of their capacity to deal with their own life, with whatever problem they're working on.
But when you say quality relationship, how does the quality or what qualities within a relationship promote healing, in your estimation?
We're talking about this in relation to our creativity conference, and so we're focusing on creativity, which is always a peer. There's no hierarchy in creativity. And so the reason I started doing these conferences was to develop a context for dialogue amongst practitioners about problems that we can't study with science. Medicine retains a kind of fantasy that science can solve all human problems, but the fact is science, to study human experience with science, excludes a large parts of human experience.
And many things that science can't explain, furthermore.
That's right, yeah. Science is a convergent way of knowing, art is a divergent way of knowing, and that's what we focus on here. And I can tell a short anecdote about our department puts on a psychopharmacology conference each year. And the administrators that run the conference have told me more than once at the break, they say, this is a different audience. They're all talking to each other. At the psychopharmacology conference, nobody talks to each other. And naturally, they talk, but there's an exuberance in this audience that I think stimulated by thinking about art.
Well, I want to get to the whole idea of art and creativity, but let's get back a little bit. I'm going to just take you back a little bit to this notion of relationship. I think you're saying something, but I'd love you to kind of say it more directly.
Okay.
There's something about the quality of relationship, maybe peer relationship or one where there isn't kind of a one-upsmanship or patronizing relationship, that has a healing effect. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yes.
And is that the concept here in terms of trying to encourage that kind of sharing or that kind of relating from patient and doctor?
Yeah. Instead of sharing, I'd say openness, openness to reflection. As I say, in creativity, there is no hierarchy that a three-year-old kid in a family therapy interview has something to say that's as valuable as what the father is saying. In fact, oftentimes it may be more honest, it may be more creative. So one of our presenters, Kyle Bass from Syracuse Stage, says, art is dialogue, and that's an interesting place to begin. I do group supervision with other therapists, and the process of these supervisory meetings is something I call creative conversation, because we can't pin things down, but we can talk openly and creatively, and
thereby share ideas and maybe grow.
That's right.
So even in what you're saying, I guess, can bring you back to the medical concept here or the healing concept, is the physician has something to offer. But it sounds to me like you're also advocating that the patient has a lot to offer and that there needs to be dialogue.
That's right. I mean, that's my view. I'm director of family therapy. And so my career in psychiatry has been organized working with families and chronic illness. And chronic illness treatment tends to get stuck. And so that's where we come in, and we get the family in to, along sometimes with medical practitioners, to talk about why things aren't going where people want it to go.
And you think at the core is this idea of open communication and relationship?
Yeah, let's say creative conversation, and non-manipulative conversation. You know, like doctors have the quality of parent, and sometimes when us parents talk to our kids, we are manipulating them. We have an outcome in mind. But in a creative conversation, we don't have an outcome in mind, where I express my view, invite you to reflect yours. If it disagrees with me, that's okay. We can still have a relationship, even though we're not quite on the same page. That's a healing context as far as I'm concerned.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink On Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. David Keith, and we're talking about the importance of relationship, especially between healthcare professionals and their patients in the healing process. So you have this creativity conference. This is going to be, or has been, the 8th annual. You do it every year.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell me more about the concept behind this creativity conference. What are you trying to accomplish in general?
Well, at the broadest, we're trying to develop open conversation about elusive issues, and we use art as a stimulus and a catalyst. And we do it each year.
So each year has a different topic?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me get back to this notion of art, because you use the words creativity, which clearly people understand. It's something new that people are that's emerging out of some kind of creative act, I guess.
Yeah.
But how do you see art and medicine interrelating, or art and life and medicine interrelating? Where are the concepts here?
Well, the title of the conference is The Theater, the Clinic, Parallels and Reverberations.
That's so, this year's conference.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But they don't interact so much as they are in parallel. But being in parallel doesn't mean disconnected.
Kind of parallel universes?
Yeah. There's a concept of parallel play amongst children.
Sure.
Two kids play together, but they don't interact. They play in parallel. But nevertheless, the play of one child affects the play of the other, even though they aren't interacting. And if one kid has to leave, the play ends. So that's how art interacts with science. They don't lay on top of each other. They're parallel to each other, and there are reverberations between them. So
they impact one
sure.
another just by their sheer existence.
Yes.
But yeah. You're making a point here about creativity and relationship.
Yeah.
How does that play out in this year's conference with this notion of theater?
Well, I got the idea from listening to an actress talk about a role that she played in a Beckett play and how difficult it was to develop that character.
And that's Samuel Beckett, well-known playwright.
Yes, who won the Nobel Prize in 1969. But I was very impressed by the dynamics between actor and director. It reminded me a lot of what's the core experience in psychotherapy.
In what respect? Say more about that.
The intensity of the relationship, the actor is actually trying to get rid of themselves so that they get out of the way of the character, whereas in psychotherapy, oftentimes the role the person plays in life, like mother, father, a construction worker, gets in the way of being a person. So we're trying to get the role out of the way so the person can re-arrive.
That's a very interesting analogy.
Yes, and anyway, so there's all these resonations between theater and clinic. Some people use dramatic methods for teaching people how to be a doctor.
I've understood that people do role-playing in psychotherapy as well.
Sure.
As a methodology for helping someone work through some emotional or psychic conflicts.
Yes, you can do that in an ongoing treatment, but I also use it in teaching so that I'll be the therapist to a role-played family. The young therapists get to learn what it's like to be the mother of a schizophrenic son, and another one gets to learn what it's like to be a schizophrenic son. It's powerful that there's a way in which even mental illness can be viewed in part as a role that a person gets caught in, and so...
That's very interesting as well. Let me get to the topics a little bit. This whole conference is fascinating, but very briefly, I don't want to run out of time. Who is Naomi Chernoff, MD, and why is this conference named after her?
Naomi passed away in 2008 at about age 50. She developed cancer and died in 8 months. She was one of our young, or she was on our faculty. Her career started in middle life, but she was an artist, and she incorporated all kinds of role play games with the residents. She ran a service on the inpatient unit. Every resident had an alter ego name that she gave.
Wow.
And so they were living this double life on the inpatient unit.
This was in the Department of Psychiatry.
Yes. It added to fun, and it raised the spirit of the inpatient unit. You were talking about how, well, I don't know what you said, that how relationships are pushed out, I guess, by business methods. And those methods are very destructive to relationships in medicine. Her playfulness resisted it, revived.
So in honor of her life and her work, you're basically doing this annual conference.
That's right. When she passed away, we were doing the conference already. We'd done two. She died, now we named it after her.
I see. So bottom line is you're attempting to do this and develop this conversation. Who comes to the conference? Who are the types of people that you're trying to reach in this whole thing?
Mostly mental health professionals. From all disciplines, psychiatry, psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy.
So you're not specifically targeting it to the internal medicine doctor?
No, but they do come. I ran into a guy in the airport. He said, "Aren't you the guy that runs that creativity conference?" That was one of the best professional experiences of my life.
Wow.
He's an internist from Oneonta.
The potential there is for anyone who's in the health care field really could benefit from something.
Even
like that.
And the general public is invited. It's open.
Very, very interesting. So you're going to cover some very interesting topics, or have covered some interesting topics in the past, but this year something we're going to look at Samuel Beckett's Endgame. I don't want to run out of time in the very little bit of time. What's the key with Endgame? What are you trying to do with that play?
We have an expert on Beckett, a man who'd been a friend of Beckett's. He lives in Auburn, New York, and he's going to be the discussant. Beckett is a very sparse theater of the absurd guy, but it's a play that is an experience. You can't understand it, you experience it, and then we have a conversation about the experience.
So it's really trying to open people up to a lot of things about experience.
That's right.
Well, these are very complex topics, fascinating, and I applaud you for the work you're doing. My guest has been Dr. David Keith. He's professor of psychiatry, director of family therapy, and the director of the Naomi Chernoff MD Creativity Conference at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks so much for coming in and sharing these concepts with us.
It was fun to do it.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. I want to read two short poems that describe the initial feelings a person can have when he or she realizes a cancer diagnosis is about to come. The first poem is by a physician, Adam Posner. He practices in Washington, D.C. His poem describes the effect the diagnosis has on him, the practitioner, as he suddenly realizes the tumor is there and he must inform the patient. His poem is called 6 o'clock, 3 centimeters from the nipple. 25 minutes into a 30-minute visit, half past the start of the physical exam, I feel it under my hand, between my second and third digits, like a pocket watch in a Dali painting, irregularly shaped, draped on the illusion of invincibility, a mass in your left breast. Time slows, as it always does, when kept by a grain of sand that refused to fall, that grew into its own hourglass. We will both remember this moment when I note space in terms of time before the digital mammogram, before the needle finer than a clock's second hand. The second poem is by a U.S. Navy veteran who later became a college English professor. His name is Robert Jacques. His poem is called Sabbatical, and he's playing on that academic notion of a sabbatical as a time away from teaching when one is supposed to work on one's literary goals. But the cancer diagnosis his speaker has just heard changes all that. Here is his sabbatical. No, I won't be here for that, nor for honors that follow, or horrors, or parties, or tumult. I put down my yen and talents, such as they are, for nothing more than time away with my thoughts, myself alone, to do whatever with whatever, come to terms with muscle, bone. Did I hear someone whisper cancer? What power that word has to scar an affable rest, time away from time and all its useful purposes, a holiday from stress. Chemo cocktails, sun-like radiation, me unbusy and less.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the importance of good perinatal care to ensure a healthy pregnancy, and we learn all about headaches. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.